Okay. Good morning. Now that we've figured out what time it is. First of all, I think last week I didn't welcome everybody back from Yom Tov. So hope everyone had a wonderful Sukkot. And yeah, now, Parshas Lech Lecha. Okay. Topic for this week, as I put it at the top of the sheet, Maaseh Avot Siman LaBanim, right, which means what?
The actions of fathers are an indication.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah, they're an indication of what's coming for the descendants. Or, as I like to think of it, you are destined to become your parents. If you take a look at the first source on the sheet, this was just random source that I found in looking around for articles about becoming one's parents. Aside from saying, I'm cutting you off financially to teach you the value of money, the greatest weapon in your parents' toolkit is the fear-inducing, you're going to be just like me someday line. Which in truth my parents didn't say to me, but it was still true. Of course, this seems insane. At first, your parents haven't listened to new music since they were 25, seem perpetually stressed, have no idea how to work Snapchat filter, and barely speak to each other. But then the further you get into adulthood, the more you notice that cliche prophecy coming true. Moving away for university made me realize that, it should be I suppose, was a lot more like my parents than I wanted to be. I worried if my roommates didn't come home from a night out. I freaked out about technology when I couldn't figure out how to set up the Wi-Fi, and I was always nagging everyone when it was their turn to take out the garbage. My parents are great people, I'm required to say this, but of course there are some, maybe many, things about them that I don't want to inherit. Naturally, I've been trying to avoid turning into them, but all I've accomplished so far is not worrying too much if my roommate was up at 4 a.m. throwing hash browns at people and stealing their cigarettes. Okay. Now that I'm back home with my family for the summer, and hopefully not much longer than that, I'm even more aware of their habits that have been passed on to me, so I asked some experts if there were any strategies for people to avoid turning into their parents. And that is, and they go on. Like, they actually, interview psychologists and so forth. But that tends to be the way the world looks at this idea. That, yes, you are doomed to display certain traits that your parents display. And you don't like it. The world says, well, we don't want to become like our parents. But the truth is, we have this basic principle where we say, Maaseh Avot Siman LaBanim, that in fact, kids will become like their parents, or at least replay some of their parents' lives. And we seem to think that it's a good thing, right? Generally speaking, in the Torah, this is viewed as a positive, right? Is that a fair statement?
Except when the traits are bad.
Right. Well, except when the traits are bad, right? Then it's not. But generally speaking, it's presented in the positive, or in the value neutral. Meaning sometimes it's just a value-neutral thing, like, obvious example from the beginning of Lech Lecha. Abraham and Sarah arrive in the land, and immediately there's a famine, and they have to go down to Egypt. And that's where Ramban makes his comment that the descendants end up having a famine, and they also go down to Egypt. That doesn't seem like good behavior, bad behavior. It's just, this was an event that happened for them, and this is an event that's going to happen now for their descendants.
No, it has a negative connotation when he says it.
A negative meaning like they were wrong to do it?
Yes.
Really?
It says, and if you put the Sadeke Sarah in the box.
That's a separate piece. That's not a condemnation of going down to Mitzrayim. And we're going to see Ramban. Oh. We're going to see the Ramban. It's different.
That has nothing to do with the Maaseh Avos. That's not the DNA. That's just what happened. There was a famine. That was what was going on with the world. It's
right.
Not the actions.
Well, it's the reaction of, there's a famine, let's go down to Mitzrayim, as opposed to, there's a famine, let's go to Aram, or there's a famine, let's, plant more, or there's a famine, let's starve, and say, we're going to stay in Israel no matter what. Right? You could have had other reactions. The reaction did not have to be, let's go to Mitzrayim. But we're going to see, because there are a lot of different ways that you can look at this. To a certain extent, it really is like what people mean when they say, in general, you become your parents. That there are traits that are similar to those of the parent, and sometimes those are good, and sometimes those may not be so good. So I brought you one example from Ibn Ezra, when the Torah introduces us to Ham and his family, we are told, V'cham hu avi Chanaan, that Ham was the father of Canaan. L'lamed sheshnehem ra'im, teaching that both are bad, u'kamase avos yasu banim, what parents do, kids are going to do as well. I think the reason why Ibn Ezra makes the comment here is because Ham has more kids. He has Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Canaan's actually the youngest. So the fact that the Torah goes out of its way to say he is the father of Canaan is trying to say there's an identity between them, that this is the kid who really, you know, took on the father's conduct. In a little bit of a different way, Ramban, later in the Chumash, when Avimelech from the Plishtim wants to make a covenant with Yitzchak, he says, I don't want you to fight me and your descendants to fight my descendants. He had made a bris with Avraham. Now he wants to make one with Yitzchak, and Ramban says, because Avraham was mighty, and therefore the assumption is Yitzchak is going to be mighty. And just like he was afraid that Avraham might attack, so too he's afraid that Yitzchak might attack. It's just shared traits that you find. And that's one model, yeah.
But did Yitzchak accept the treaty? Because Avraham didn't.
Avraham did accept the treaty, and so did Yitzchak.
Oh, he did?
Yes. Both Avram and Yitzchak did. There is criticism. I think it's either Ramban or Rashbam for making that treaty, saying that they weren't supposed to do that. But yes, they both made the treaty. Sorry.
Because I thought he said no because he didn't want him to think that he made him wealthy.
No, that's the king of Sodom after the distribution of the loot, as well as the captives from the war of the four kings and the five kings. Right? And that wasn't a treaty, that was just, you know, here's what I want from the spoils, and here's what I want to give you. And Avram says, I'm not interested. Right. Whether that would have been like a treaty is an interesting question in its own right. So one way to look at sort of the replication in Masa Avos Siman Labanim is the way Ibn Ezra uses it here, which is just, there are certain things your parents do, and you're going to end up doing them too. You're going to be like them. There's another way to look at it, which is also not really the focus that I want to have, but I wanted to note it because some of the examples of it are very interesting. And that is that children will be held to account for what their parents did. So that masa avos, that which ancestors did, will be a sign of what their children will experience. Siman Labanim, it's a sign of what the children are going to go through. So, I mean, that's sort of classic, the idea, right? And the Torah says, Pokedav on Avos Labanim, that Hashem may zap descendants if they emulate the sins of their parents. But here, I wanted to show you this, because I came across this medrash and thought it was really, really interesting. In source number 3, we know that Avram and Sarah do not show up in the land of Canaan alone, right? Who else is with them?
Lot.
Right. Lot is related how? Lot is related how?
Through Sarah.
Sarah's brother.
No. Right.
Yeah.
Sarah. Abram's nephew from before.
By definition, he's also Abram's nephew because Sarah is Abram's niece. But he's also Sarah's brother. Right? And he's much more in the story. He's much more like the brother-in-law than he is a nephew.
Yeah. Why does he treat him like that?
Because he's also a nephew.
Who,
Lot? Yeah,
it says that he's Avram's brother's son.
And he's also Sarah's brother.
Oh.
Right. Right? That's just the way it is. It's true. So,
limited choices, right?
That may be. But take a look at source number 3, where you find two different views in the Medrash about how they bring Lot along with them. Vashem Amar El Avram. This pasuk is after Avram and Lot split up, right? There's too much cattle and there isn't enough land for it, so Lot, you know, pick a direction and just go. And Lot says, okay, I'll take the entire shore of the Yarden, you can have everything else. So after that, Hashem speaks to Avram. So look at this. Rav Yehuda Omer, Ka'as haya la'Avraham Avinu b'sha shepiresh Lot ben Achiv me'imo. Rav Yehuda says Hashem is angry that Avraham has Lot separate from him. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, La'kol hu medabek, ulalot achiv eino medabek. This guy Avraham is a chevroman. He's with everybody. He's willing to reach out and talk and welcome people into his tent and whatever it is. And his own brother-in-law, he's chasing away. wrong for chasing him away. That's Rabbi Yehuda. Then you get Rabbi Nechemia. Rabbi Nechemia Amar Kas Hayalo Lakadosh Baruch Hu B'Shashay Mahalech Lod Im Avraham Avinu. Rabbi Nechemia says it's the opposite. Hashem was angry when Avraham had Lod to travel with him. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Ani Amarti Lo Lezarach Hanasati Es Haaretz Hazos. I said to you that I'm giving this land to your descendants. V'hu Matbik Es Lod Ben Achiv K'deli Yorshav. And he takes his nephew, so there you go, he's identified here as a nephew. He's going to bring his nephew with him to inherit from him. Imken Yelich V'yavilo Shnei Prastikin Men Ashuk V'yorishay Met Shalom. Why doesn't he just go take two foundlings from the marketplace and let them, you know, get the land? Kamoshu wrote to Ben Achiv like he wants his nephew. I assume the two foundlings is a reference to Yishmael and Esav. The idea that they're going to also claim the land. Since you brought in Lot, therefore, you're going to have to split the land with others. The reason I bring this is, first of all, I think it's a really interesting question. Is he right or wrong for the way he handles Lot? Both for bringing him along, when he was told, leave your family behind, and then for separating from him. And there's a lot to be said about that. Maybe another Parsha Shira on Lech Lecha, we'll talk more about the Abraham-Lot dynamic. But we talked about Lot anyway last year, right? We talked about the other end of Lot's career, the end of his career. But but also the idea that what happens with Abraham ends up having results for his descendants. Avram brings in Lot to the land and is willing to give him area in Eretz Yisrael. Now his descendants are going to also have to share the land with others. There's an element of punishment there. And then on the other hand, we have the idea that also the way they conduct themselves leads to reward for their descendants. And here's another one, also part of the Lot scheme. Take a look at number four. Here's a medrash in which we are told that this medrash is on the fight that Avram fights to save Lot, the war of the four kings and the five kings. So the pasuk says, "Vayechalek aleihem laila." Vayechalek aleihem laila. The word "vayechalek" is an odd word. You could translate "vayechalek" as "he split up," meaning Avram's forces split up and went in different directions at night to attack these kings and their armies. However, the way the Medrash reads it is that he split the night, that Avraham pursued these armies until midnight. And that's what the Medrash is building on here, when it says, Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Avim pa'al imi v'chatzi halayla. Their father, the Jews' father, meaning Avraham, acted with me at midnight. Saving Lot, in other words, was a good thing. So I am going to act for his descendants at midnight. When is that? B'Mitzrayim, when Hashem strikes the Egyptian firstborn at midnight. So here, there's a reward coming for the descendants modeled on the actions of the ancestor. Clear?
What happened with Lot at midnight?
That Abraham fought the armies that had taken Lot captive. One other example of this is in source number 5, also a very interesting medrash. Rav Yehuda Marav. Rav Yehuda says, quoting, Rav Komasha Asa Avram Lamalachea Shares Ba'atzmo, Asa Kadosh Baruch Lebanav Ba'atzmo. Everything that Abraham did for those visiting Malachim in the beginning of Parshas Vayera, what he did himself, Hashem does for his descendants himself. Whereas Komasha Asa Avram Lede Shaliach, when Avram sends somebody else to do something, so he says, Sarah, you do this, Yishmael, you do that, then Hashem did it for his kids via an agent also. And that's talking about the man and the water and the like in the Midbar. So there are parallels between what Avram does for the Malachim personally versus via agent, and what Hashem is willing to do for us in the Midbar. Also worth discussing, but also not for right now. These are all just our side notes in terms of the big picture that we're seeing. Masa avosim and labanim so far can be a natural statement. Children will have traits that resemble those of their parents. And it can be a reward or punishment. Whatever the parents do is going to have an impact on their children in terms of good results or bad results. But then you have parallel experiences that seem not to be about children emulating parents and don't seem to be about reward and punishment. And that's where I wanted to go with this. So, for example, the descent to Mitzrayim, and here we see what Ramban says. Source number 6. On that descent to Mitzrayim. Omar lecha, yeah, the Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, the English is on the top of the next side. Omar lecha klal. He says, I'm going to give you a rule, Ramban says. Tavino so bechol ha-parshios ha-ba'os be'inyan Avram Yitzchak v'Yaakov. And he says, once I give you this rule, you will see it in everything that's to come, the next few generations. V'hu inyan gadol. This is a big deal. This is a great matter. His giru raboseinu b'derach ketzara, our sages already mentioned it in short form, v'amru, saying, komashe ira la'avos simen labanim. Whatever happened to the ancestors is a sign for their kids. It's interesting, he goes to the Medrash Tanchuma, because it's actually a pretty good example in an older Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, which we'll see. And he says, that's why the text goes on, to talk about how they journeyed here and they journeyed there, and about how they dug wells, and all the other events that happened. So you look at it and you think, this is superfluous. Why did you need to tell me all of this? But they're teaching you about the future. When, in fact, you see something happen from one of these patriarchs, from that you can deduce what's going to happen to his descendants. That's Ramban's perspective on it. And in fact, I brought you a medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, in source number 7. This is the one I was surprised that Ramban didn't mention, because it gives you a very, very clear way to look at it. I did not translate it, just because it's basically psukim. It's basically just verses. But we'll go through it line by line just to see what it is the medrash is talking about, the parallels that it draws. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Avram Avinu, Hashem says to Avram, Sei ukvoshes haderech lefnei banecha, go, conquer the way before your descendants. Atamotze komashakasu ba'Avram, ksiv b'banav. And sure enough, whatever it says about Avram, it says regarding his kids. So Avram is going to pave the way. How so? The first line is, Avram has a famine, and then there's a famine for his grandchildren. Second line, Avram goes down to Egypt, Yaakov goes down to Egypt. Third, or Yisrael, the nation, really. With Abraham, the pasuk says he went down to Egypt, lagur sham. That's the wording that's used. And for the Jews, they said to Paro, lagur ba'aretz banu. That's what Yaakov says. That's what Yosef says to them. Tell Paro, lagur ba'aretz banu. We've come lagur. So the same language is used for the way they're going to live there. With Abraham, it says ki chaved haraav be'aretz kenohan. That's the wording. And with the Jews, it says, Baharav Kaved Barat, same description of the famine. With Avram, it says, when they came to Egypt, Vahi Kasher Hikriv. With the Jews, it says, Uparo Hikriv. That's actually cheating, because Paro Hikriv is when we're leaving Egypt. Paro Hikriv was when Paro caught up to the Jews at the Yamsuf. It's a little different. With Avram, it says, Avram says to Sarah, "Behargu osi ve'osach yechayu." They're going to kill me and keep you alive. And with the Jews, they in fact want to kill the males. They want to kill the baby boys. With Avram, he says to Sarah, "Say that you are my sister, so that I will benefit for you." Yitav is the key word. And with the Jews, it says, "Vayetev Elokim lamayalados." Hashem was good to the midwives. These are all. So far on this one story, and actually, it basically is all about the story of Mitzrayim. With Avram, it says when Avram arrived in Egypt, Kivo Avram Mitzrayimah. Then it says when the Jews come, Shmos Bnei Yisrael Habayim Mitzrayimah. And it talks about how Avram had great wealth, and the Jews came out with great wealth. And with Avram, it says Vayitzav Alav Paro. Paro gave orders that he should be treated well. And with the Jews, it says Vatechzak Mitzrayim Alam, that Egypt. Well, there it's actually a negative. I'm not sure about that one. Vayitzav Alav Paro and Vatechzak Mitzrayim Alam are kind of opposites. Vayitzav Alav Paro is Paro sent a message saying, "Don't hurt Avram." But Techzak Mitzrayim Alam is when Egypt sends the Jews out of Egypt. Not sure. And then Avram, Vayelech Masa'av, he traveled on his way. This is now after Egypt. And with the Jews, it says Eilem Mas'ei B'nei Yisrael, using the same terminology. Either way, the Medrash goes on at length to talk about and give examples of this. And bless you, the Medrash Tanchuma that Ramban brings also has it. So here's our question. Notwithstanding Dina's point about the way that Sarah comes down to Mitzrayim, although I realize afterwards you're mixing two stories, the story of Sarah and the story of Dina. Dina is the one in the box who Yaakov was criticized for.
About that it was bad that they put the Sadeges.
That's regarding Dina. That's not regarding Sarah. Yeah, sorry. That's what you're thinking of. It was the issue of
talking about myself as number one.
I don't believe so.
And that if I had like a very negative that like Avram went down and that's why his astrology goes down.
So there are those who read this in a negative light, but it's not Ramban. There are those who read it in a negative light, like he should have believed that Hashem was going to take care of them and stay in the land. But generally speaking, that's not the trend. No.
And it's a bad thing to go look for food.
Well, like I said, most of the commentators do not think it was wrong. Most of the commentators do not criticize it. They actually look at it as one of the 10 tests. In other words, is he going to say, well, God, yeah, you brought me into this land in order for me to starve. You know, enough of this already. And the fact that he doesn't, he's passing the test. But what I'm looking at here is fundamentally a value-neutral event in which we're told Avram did this and now his kids are going to do the same thing and experience all of these parallels. So here's my question to you. It took us 20 minutes to get here, but we're here. What is the overall message of Masa Avos Siman Levanim? Not talking about when it's a reward or punishment, not talking about it's an emulation of parental traits, but in general, what does this say to us? Why is this a thing? Why does it matter that parents will go through an experience and then the children are going to replicate the experience and perhaps even make the same decisions?
Is it an active choice or is it just saying it will happen? That's what I can't
maybe to inspire us.
Right now it sounds like it's automatic.
To inspire us to be good people because we have an effect on our children's future.
So, and look at yourselves as the avos to the next generation and recognize that whatever you do may play out with them. Okay. I'm going to come back to an idea that's similar to that.
Or it'd be the opposite, that your path is already set out because you're going to copy whatever your parents do.
Very deterministic, right? Well, you just like your parents did this and you're just stuck with it.
Very history repeats itself like over and over and over again.
Right.
Right, like what did Mitzrayim do to have that happen to them?
Well, they're just a side player, really. You just happen to be in the wrong place.
No, sorry. I mean, B'nai Israel.
It's
not their fault that their grandfather went down to Mitzrayim, so now they have to, too.
Correct.
But maybe go for the more prelim, meaning you're always supposed to go down, so.
But then there's no...
Why is that? Because Avram went, they have to go. Maybe it's because they were going, so Avram has to go.
So that's going to be one of the ideas we have to look at also, is which way is the cause and effect? So I want to look at this on three different levels. First level is I think the most basic, and that is, as I called it on here, a bond. And the idea is not so much that there's value in the particulars of what happens, as that there's an authentic connection between the parents and the children, demonstrated by their shared experiences. We really are their descendants, which in the context of Abraham and family has a connotation of worthiness, that it's not just that we are some group of people who can claim that our great-grandparents were wonderful people, but no, we're really like them, right? If you think of the Midrashim that talk about how, the Pasuk says, Ve'ela toldos Yitzchak ben Abraham, Abraham holidas Yitzchak. The Torah introduces Parshas Toldos. These are the descendants of, or chronicles of, Yitzchak, son of Abraham. Abraham produced Yitzchak. And the Midrash says, why did you add that? We already said Yitzchak, son of Abraham. We therefore figured it out, right? And the answer is that Yitzchak resembles Abraham. So when people saw Yitzchak, they said, oh, that's Abraham's kid. they that there was such an identity between them, that's more than just a random observation of, hey, he looks like him. It's a statement of similarity, a statement of authenticity as a descendant, and that's something that's really important in our history. And I brought you one example of this that I think carries it very well, and that is the building of the, or not just the building of, the whole series of events surrounding the second Beis HaMikdash. I brought you Pesukim from Ezra, or Pasuk from Ezra here. There's another passage in Haggai that's just as good, but I happen to have the Ezra one available to cut and paste, so I did that one. This is describing the scene when they dedicate the Mizbeach and they start building the second Beis HaMikdash. And they're doing this whole big dedication, and everybody's supposed to be happy because they've come back from Babel / Persia to be back in Israel. And look at the description here. V'rabim me'akohanim v'halaviyim v'rashei ha'avos ha'zikeinim asher ra'u es ha'bayis ha'rishon b'yosdo ze ha'bayis be'inehem bochim b'kol gadol. The sentence is a little bit hard to read in the Hebrew because kind of it starts in the beginning and it really jumps to the end and then back to the middle. But many of the Kohanim and Levim and the heads of the families who had seen the first Beis HaMikdash look at the second one and they start crying. And they say, this doesn't resemble at all what we had. And it doesn't. First Beis HaMikdash is grand and glorious. It's built by Shlomo HaMelech. What they have at this stage is a little puny Mizbeach and whatever they can put together with what the Persians gave them to be able to build a Beis HaMikdash. They're in poverty, they're vulnerable, they're afraid that their endeavor does not match up. So what did they do? So they did a bunch of things. First of all, they appoint a Kohen Gadol. And they appoint a gentleman by the name of Yehoshua. Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. If you're familiar, actually, was it Haftarah last week? No, it wasn't. Last week was Haftarah for Noah. Never mind. But it'll be the Haftarah on Hanukkah. And again in Baal Oscha. That's what I was thinking of. The story in Zechariah, of Zechariah envisioning Yehoshua the Kohen Gadol, standing in front of the Malach. That's this Yehoshua who is their Kohen Gadol. Commentators ask a question. You pick Yehoshua to be your Kohen Gadol. This is not Yehoshua who took the Jews into Israel. It was centuries and centuries later. Different person altogether. But you had somebody named Ezra who was also a Kohen and who would demonstrate himself to be a phenomenal leader. Why did you pick this fellow Yehoshua as your Kohen Gadol? Why didn't you pick Ezra as your Kohen Gadol? Says Ibn Ezra, take a look at source number 9. V'yahot Sadak avi Yehoshua haya Kohen Gadol b'bayis Rishon kasher nisraf. Because Yehoshua's father was the Kohen Gadol in the first Beis HaMikdash at the time when it was destroyed. Kikain kasuv, as it is recorded. Akein yarash b'no ma'alaso b'tseis Yisrael migolos Babel. So his son inherits the position when they leave Babel. And therefore, Lo Shimesh Ezra Dodo Bekuna Gedola Bimei Yehoshua. Ezra did not serve as Kohen Gadol as long as Yehoshua was alive. And therefore, also in the days of his son and grandson, as Yehoshua Kohen Gadol passes it down to his son and grandson. There is some debate on whether Ezra ever served as Kohen Gadol. But the point that Ibn Ezra makes is you picked your Kohen Gadol not based on who the best one was for the job, but because you wanted continuity from the first Beis HaMikdash. You wanted that sense of, we are like them. And it goes way beyond that. I gave you a list of items in 10 and 11, rather than drag you through all the psukim. But look at what you see here in 10 and 11. First of all, number 10. The materials they used for the construction. We're told in the third parak in Ezra, they used Arzei HaLevanon, cedar from Lebanon, and they brought in craftsmen from Tsur. First Beis HaMikdash, Malachim Aleph Perek Hey, they used wood from Lebanon, and they had the craftsmen from Hiram, king of Tsur. You're replicating the materials as well as the place where they got it. They built the Beis HaMikdash with layers of wood and marble, as described in the fifth parak in Ezra, which was what they did with the first Beis HaMikdash in Malachim Aleph, parak Vav. It's 60 amos tall, according to Ezra, parak Vav, and the Da'at Mikra edition, he suggests that's parallel to the first Beis HaMikdash, although I'm not sold exactly on the parallel he sees there, but he said it. But they're doing things never explicitly. Meaning, you can read Sefer Ezra from cover to cover, and you will never find a pasuk that says, we did this in order to look like what they did. But it's so clear cut. You're using the same materials, the same craftsmen, the same, you know, sort of design, in potentially the same height, in order to do it just the way that it was done the first time.
There wasn't a requirement?
Nope. None of these are requirements.
Well, no, that's why you have examples.
I thought these are not requirements.
These are not requirements, right. Like, requirement would be like, have a shulchan, have a menorah, right? Mm-hmm. Those things, the mizbeach.
The itself being like, oh, this is a nice thing to do, let's do it the same.
Let's do it the way they
did. They want to recreate it.
Yes. Yes. And his grandeur built it. Mm-hmm. Did he have any nevuah from Hashem, anything, any inspiration?
So we're told that there are aspects of the first Beis HaMikdash which David actually gives him the plans for, and he's doing it with nevuah, whether that's David's own nevuah, whether that's from God or Nasan is not at all clear, but that comes with nevuah, and David even provides materials. This time round, you have Haggai and Zechariah there, and it could be, the text doesn't say, it could be that they actually say to them, do this. All the text tells us is, this is what they did.
Yeah, you find that now, after the war, that, you know, they came here and they built the shuls exactly like in Europe.
Yep.
Forest Hill Shul.
Forest Hill.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. It's a replica.
We're getting 770 Chabad. Mm-hmm. Like,
All over the world.
Yeah.
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 I mean, it's just like a cute idea. It's not shocking.
So I think it's a lot more than a cute idea. I think there's a lot more going on, because take a look at the next line.
It could be a lot more going on, but it's not like if you heard another religion do the same thing, like you wouldn't think it was strange.
It's not shocking.
Oh, no, not at all. I wouldn't think it's strange at all.
No,
that's 100% true. Take a look at number 11. The calendar is the same. Meaning, they dedicate the Mizbeach on Sukkot. If you remember the Haftarah that we read in Shul on the beginning of Sukkot, they dedicated the first Beis HaMikdash on Sukkot. Right? Shlomo has this whole 14-day celebration. They start to build the actual building in the second month, in Iyar. Happens to be that that's the same month when Shlomo started to build the Beis HaMikdash. Ezra, remember, is not even present at this point. Right? If you remember where the chronology works, Ezra leaves Bavel after the first Beis HaMikdash is already dedicated, or the Mizbeach is dedicated, and he arrives right after the building is dedicated. Ezra leaves Bavel in the month of Nisan. Just like the Jews leaving Mitzrayim, he leaves in the month of Nisan. He actually arrives in Av. And I think there's some symbolism in that as well. Not really a reenactment, but there's symbolism there of reversing the destruction of the first was in Av, and now I'm arriving and it's Av. But the idea here, yes, is one that it wouldn't surprise me to see in any culture, wanting to reproduce, you know, what was done earlier. But I think in any culture it would carry the same message. Right? The message is to say, we are like our righteous ancestors. We are like them. And interestingly, that comes up in what I think of as a meta reenactment. It's a reenactment of a reenactment. Anyone here ever in Israel for Hakeel? Okay, so Hakeel, sorry.
Me probably.
You were. But.
Yeah.
So Hakeel is supposed to happen the year after Shemitah. Okay, so we have another one coming up in a couple of years.
Every 7 years.
Miketz Shavashim Taseh Shemitah. It's the way Shemitah works, so therefore this will be every seven, this one. So it's the year after Shemitah on Sukkot. And what happens is, everyone is supposed to gather to the site of the Beis HaMikdash, and the king is supposed to read sections of Chumash for everybody. In 1946, Rabbi Herzog, the first chief rabbi of the state, said we should do Hakeil, even though the technical mitzvah doesn't apply right now. Nonetheless, we should do a zecher. We should commemorate the way it was done. And it's very ironic to me, just because Hakeil itself is a commemoration. If you take a look at the Rambam that I brought you in source number 12, he talks about how everyone shows up to Hakeil, and he says, V'gerim she'enan makirin, those who convert to Judaism and don't really know Hebrew well enough to really understand what's being read, they have to prepare themselves in order to hear with respect, awe, joy, trembling, like the day the Torah was given at Sinai. What Hakeil is supposed to be is every 7 years the Jews reenact Matan Torah. We now, every 7 years, reenact the Jews reenacting Matan Torah.
Is there no difference between like doing this and like deciding that you want to start building a Beis HaMikdash?
I mean, there are substantive differences.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this, you don't go up onto Har HaBayit in order to do this. You do it in the Kotel Plaza. So you're not breaking any rules in order to do it. You're not running into any questions like purity and impurity or like needing a Navi in order to do something. Yeah, this is relatively benign.
Who says the Tefillah?
So I think they...
I feel like it was controversial.
The
That wouldn't surprise me, but
there's a major debate as to whether it has to be the king. Is this royal by definition, or whether it's simply a powerful person? But you know, I don't know who did it the last time. But there was discussion: should it be a member of Knesset? Should it be the chief rabbi? You know, chief rabbi. Which of the chief rabbis?
Fine.
Yeah.
Was 1946 the end of the 7-year cycle?
Yeah. Or he made the decree in 1946. You can do the math, right? We're now in 5-7. Well, do it the other way. Mm-hmm. 1946 was 5-7-0-6, right? And it happens to be that the way our Shemitah cycle works, if you just divide it by 7, you get, you know, it divides evenly. So that would leave you with what, 106 and 70 and 36. Yes, that was the year after Shemitah. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, that's a contemporary example of this, but the core idea is relatively straightforward. Maaseh avot siman labanim, that which our ancestors did is a sign for their descendants, meaning it demonstrates a relationship. That's one idea. Second idea is Ramban's idea. And here, the reason it's only in English on here is because I cut and pasted from a source sheet that I made for a different year and did not go back to actually bring in the Hebrew. So I apologize, but if anyone really wants it and, you know, emails me, I will be glad to send you the original. That's also true. So this is Ramban in the beginning of Lech Lecha, and he says something mystical here. And the idea is that the initial experience of the Avot, of the first generation, is meant to begin the implementation of what Hashem is going to do for later generations. Hashem wants to do something for the Banim, for the descendants, and he does it to the Avot, to the Avos, whichever side of the table you're on. He does it for the Avos in order to begin the realization of that. In other words, the Jews are destined to go down to Mitzrayim. Hashem makes that real by beginning to implement it for Avram and Sarah and their family. Take a look at Ramban in number 13. Know that all the decrees of heaven become irreversibly enduring once they cease being decrees and become active and visible. And therefore God had Avram begin to take control of Israel. He made Avram model all that would happen with his descendants. Maharal applies this to the practice of having apples and honey on Rosh Hashanah. It's funny, I use this, the sheet that this came from was a shear on apples and honey and the sweet foods on Rosh Hashanah. someone showed me the new art scroll RCA sitter that came out. They quoted my shir with my name and everything. Yeah, bottom of page 932. They did not ask me. I mean, I'm annoyed because I actually had better ideas since the time I gave that shir. Like, it's not there. But yeah, page 932. That's my claim to fame. So if you take a look at the Maharal, he talks about why people have sweet foods and foods with nice messages on Rosh Hashanah night. And he says, now know and understand this, for it is an amazing insight to create for a heavenly decree an emulation and sign below so that the good will come to pass and the decree will be fulfilled for the good. Therefore, it is fitting to create a sign and emulation as we find the prophets did. In other words, you make the Gezerah real by actually having it take place. The implementation begins. This is the matter of emulating and eating or seeing at the start of the year items which have a good sign, so that the decree will emerge into reality and the good decree will thereby be fulfilled. And he says it's not nichush, it's not sorcery, it's preparation for the fulfillment of the decree for the good. That's the idea. This is what they meant when they said, in the Gemara, since we say that signs are substantive, it is substantive in this regard that via the sign, the decree will emerge into positive reality. So in other words, what Maharal applies to the apples and honey, based on Ramban, who applies it with Abraham, is that Hashem wants something to happen. Once it begins to happen, it's irreversible. So Hashem starts it with the earlier generation, and now it must happen with a later generation. And what I find about this that's fascinating is it's the reversal of what we said regarding the bond. Meaning, our first approach was to say the descendants are demonstrating they're part of their ancestors. And it adds purpose to their actions, it adds meaning to their actions. You know, we are like our ancestors. This shifts the focus, it reverses it. Instead of saying that the ancestors were the main thing, and we are just their descendants living out, you know, a model, you know, something modeled on their lives, it's just the opposite. We are the purpose. And the ancestors had to experience what they experienced in order to set up what Hashem wants for us.
It's like limiting Hashem's power. Like, he doesn't need to do that. He can just make whatever happens to us happen.
Right. So what Ramban is doing here is sort of standard in Kabbalah. And Ramban, remember, is a mystic. And he believes that there are certain rules that God has set up by which not only will the natural universe function, but also God's intervention will function. So yes, he can just easily tear up the rule book. If Hashem decides, nah, I don't want to go into Mitzrayim, then they're not going to Mitzrayim. Nonetheless, these are the rules by which Hashem operates, and they are as real to Ramban as the law of gravity is.
But you could also go further and say, well, what's the reason for that rule? Like, why did God make this rule that way?
Right. And I would think, although Ramban doesn't say, but I would think it's the idea that it's once Hashem has started to perform this, it must be so, just because it's something God has already begun to make real. It's now concrete. And to reverse it would be to, unlike where Hashem says, I'm going to destroy Nineveh, or I'm going to destroy Yerushalayim in the days of Chizkiyahu, where you can do tshuva and then it isn't going to happen. Once it's begun, it's too late.
So, could you say that it's making it more palatable? Like, in that way?
What do you mean?
For all of us to know that, like, our ancestors have to experience that thing, so by the time it happens to us, or that we're born into it, we're used to it.
Well, that only works for the negative ones, not for the happy ones.
Right.
The happy ones don't need me to get used to it.
Right. But
this has a positive side also. I'm not sure. But I'll throw you a third idea, which this is, you know, I was talking to my daughter about this, and she said, once I told her the first two, she said, okay, but the third one's the one you like best, because, you know, that's always the one you do last. It happens to be my own, so therefore, yes, I do like it. The idea is this: the event that takes place with the earlier generation, that initial experience, translates into a greater religious experience for the descendants. You build on what the ancestors experienced, and here's where you'll see this. It applies in Lech Lecha. What was the substance of Lech Lecha about, this initial Lech Lecha mission? What was supposed to happen? What was Hashem asking of Abraham and Sarah and their family?
Leave
Leave everything you had, right? Everything, family, land, birthplace, whatever, leave it all behind and go to the place I'm going to show you. Right? He doesn't say, go to the land of Canaan. He says, the land I'm going to show you. Right? That's it. Yitzchak, right, has his own Lech Lecha experience, literally. Right? At the end of Parshas Vayera, Hashem says, Lech Lecha el Eretz HaMoriah. Same words. Go to the land of Moriah, and Abraham is the one who's getting this instruction, to the mountain that I'm going to show you. Bring him up as a carbon on this mountain. Yitzchak has to take this journey with Abraham, going to a place he doesn't know. Rivka makes the journey also. Right? Rivka, remember, is going to marry Yitzchak. She leaves her family and everything behind. And by the way, Yitzchak doesn't go home after the Akedah. Right? Yitzchak ends up Yeshiva Shem Be'er, according to the Medrash, but just a straightforward read. It says, the pasuk says, Abram goes back. Yitzchak, we don't know where he is. He's gone. He doesn't go home. But then Rivka also makes this journey from her home, right, with Abram's servant, and they ask her, do you want to go? And she says, Eileich, I'm going to go. She doesn't know where she's going, and again, she's never coming home again. Right? Rivka lives her life in Israel. Yaakov also makes this journey repeatedly, right? He goes from Israel to Aram, and then he goes back into Israel. He does not, it appears, get home to see Yitzhak, at least certainly in terms of the text itself. We never get any reunion of Yaakov and Yitzhak. Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, Zilpah also all leave their homeland. Yosef's entire life is a Lech Lecha, right? This journey down to Mitzrayim, and again, he also does not get to go home, right? Yosef is brought home to Shechem, right, where he never lived, to be buried. And then their descendants, the former Abadim, the slaves in Mitzrayim, have to also make a journey like that to leave Mitzrayim. They were born there. This is all they ever knew. And to leave and go to Israel. And the Medrash picks up on it. I brought you Midrashim in 16 and 17 about how Hashem tests Abraham and Hashem tests the generation in the Midbar. And Abraham goes up to his neck in the water on the way to the Akedah, and they have to go into the water of Yamsuf. Each generation has to undergo a Lech Lecha, abandonment of what you knew, to follow Hashem to go somewhere else. And you're never going to go back to where you were. And not only that, every generation, every year, had a mitzvah like that. What was the mitzvah? What's the mitzvah of Lech Lecha once the Jews get into the land? Aliyah L'Regel. Right? Three times a year, you have to go to Yerushalayim. Three times a year, leave behind everything you have and go to Har HaMoriah, in fact. But stronger than that, take a look at source number 18. And this I got from Rabbi Menachem Ginnack, his Sefer Gan Shoshanim, points this out. Source number 18. Ki orish goyim mipanecha, Hashem says, when I conquer the nations before you, v'hirchavti as givulecha, and I broaden your boundaries, v'lo yachmod ish es artzecha, no one will desire your land, balos chale ra'osas p'nei Hashem alokecha shalosh pemim bashana, when you go to be seen before Hashem three times each year. So Hashem promises, don't worry about all the property you're leaving behind, right? Imagine, right? All the Jews. You ever think about what Aliyah L'Regel looked like? You know, not everybody went, realistically. But what was supposed to happen was everybody would just, you know, pick up and move, and that's it. And we're all go to Yerushalayim for Yom Tov. But not only that, take a look at the Gemara Pesachim in source number 19. Amar Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Ami says, Kol Adam Sheyesh Lo Karka Ola L'Regel, V'Shein Lo Karka Ein Ola L'Regel. Only if you have land do you have a mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel. If you don't own land, there's no mitzvah. Why is that?
Because you shouldn't feel like a sense of permanence.
You have to have something to leave behind.
The mitzvah is the leaving, not the going.
Exactly. Perfectly worded. The mitzvah is the leaving, not the going. I want to write that down. That's what they are supposed to do, is to reenact the Lech Lecha experience, converting it from the personal experience of Abraham and Sarah to the national experience of the Jews as a whole. This is an example of what I'm suggesting for Maisa Avos Siman Labanim in general, which is to take the experiences that they had and to actually build on them to create a greater experience. What Abraham and his family did initially, that one trip, becomes this national annual celebration. And what it does, I didn't bring it on the sheet, which is really too bad, is that it turns history into memory. Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, who's a professor at Columbia, wrote a book called Zachor. It's brilliant. He talks about, especially in his introduction, what history means for Jews. He talks about the fact that classically Jews never wrote history books. We just didn't do that. At the same time, the Torah is filled with the verb zachor, right? Remember the war with Amalek, remember you were slaves in Egypt, remember this, remember that, right? We have the Sheish Zachiros, six things you're supposed to remember every day. But the distinction is between history, where you're aware of something that happened in the past, and memory, where you call it to mind to make it part of who you are today. And to me, Maaseh Avos Siman Labanim, what the ancestors did, comes back into our lives as something that is active, as something that we recreate and we build on, right? As I put on the sheet, building on the shoulders of giants. So that, to sum up the three ideas, first of all, Maaseh Avos Siman Labanim is a bond. They had something. We have the same experience that demonstrates our authenticity. We really are their descendants. That makes us special. Second, it's what they experienced is actually the beginning of an implementation of what's going to be true for us. And so they in fact are the foreshadowing of our experience, and we are then the focus. And again, as noted before, we are the avos for a future generation. So the same thing is true in our own lives. There's still a sense of purpose to the future generation that we are building towards. And then the third idea is that what the ancestors went through becomes the building material that we are now going to use to expand on it in our experience. And if Avram and Sarah go down to Mitzrayim, that's the material for what's going to happen when Yaakov and his family go down to Mitzrayim. And when Avram and Sarah do a Lech Lecha journey, that's going to become the material that will develop into Aliyah L'Regel. And then it's up to us to ask ourselves, so what are we doing? You know, what is it that happened with my ancestors, whether you talk about way back, you know, Chumash, or whether you talk about more immediate ancestry? What is it that they did that we are going to build on as well? That's the idea.
Very nice.
Thanks. I like it.
Could it be establishment of Israel?
Yeah.
Could it be that every time...